English moderator, but I promise they're not linked, and I will be celebrating St. Patrick's Day with the rest of you. Joining us for this discussion, Jim Sutter, CEO of the U.S. Soybean Export Council. We've also got Everett Eisenstadt, partner at Squire Patton Boggs. Everett also served as deputy director of the National Economic Council during the first Trump administration, among other positions. And we have Alexis Taylor, chief global policy officer at the International Fresh Produce Association. Alexis was also the USDA Undersecretary for Trade during the Biden administration. And finally, we have Michael Dykes, President and CEO of the International Dairy Foods Association. So we're turning our attention now to global markets and policy shaping agriculture trade. But before we kick off, I'd like you to retrieve your phones because we have another Slido question for you. So this one, we've got a yes or no. The question is, I believe on there, are you in favor of President Trump's new tariffs on Canada, Mexico, and China? Yeah, and we had to specify Canada, Mexico, and China, these ones. Wow, okay, so we've got 81-89% no. Interesting, maybe not interesting. We are in D.C., 13% yes. Okay, I guess Bob Lighthizer's not in the audience, or maybe he is. So I'm really looking forward to this discussion because we've got folks here with a wealth of experience. You were all involved in trade policy making long before it was cool, so to speak. And it's obviously now become a kitchen table issue for households across America. And in Trump's second term, trade policy seems to be in some ways economic policy. You know, tariffs are being floated as a way to reshore domestic manufacturing, balance the budget, pay for lower taxes for Americans, and address the fentanyl and illegal migration crisis. We mentioned in our question, we've got new tariffs on China, Canada, and Mexico. We've also had new steel and aluminium tariffs as well. And potentially we have reciprocal tariffs on the way. So I wanted to start with you, Everett. Based on what we've seen so far, how does this second Trump administration's trade policy approach differ from his first administration?
Well, I thought of two ways. Now I've thought of three. The pace is obviously much, much faster. During the first administration, it took about a year and a half till tariffs really kicked in. It started kind of slow with the 201 on washing machines and the 232, and then, of course, the 301 China tariffs, which two of those are still in place, the 232 steel and aluminum tariffs and the 301 on China. So the pace now, obviously, we're, 55 days, I think? I'm not sure I have it exactly right, but more or less. And we already have tariffs imposed on some of our largest trading partners. We already have threats of retaliation. So the pace is much, much faster. Second, as you noted, the rationale was debated vigorously during the first administration. We would have policy debates about tariffs. Are they a tool? Are they an outcome? And some people in the administration at that time really thought tariffs were the best policy, best economic policy, that they would make America rich, and that was their position. Others felt that the tariffs were great as a negotiating tool to, you know, you bring up tariffs and maybe get others to lower barriers. So now they're both. Now they're everything. They're not just they're an outcome and a tool and a revenue raiser. So that's very different. And then I think the third is the central place they are in the president's economic agenda. They're not a sideshow. They're one of the centerpieces. And I think that's a big shift that's really impacting the psychology of a lot of traders and companies. And it's also one of the first things to come out. We still have, you know, tax and energy and some of these other policies have yet to be implemented, yet tariffs are at the forefront. So that's a few ways. I could probably come up with more, but that's probably enough to set the scene.
Fantastic, yeah. And obviously, all of these tariff actions are set to significantly impact these export industries and commodities like the groups that you represent. So how are your industries navigating this new trade environment? And do you see opportunities as well as risks, or is it all risks? Jim, maybe we could start with you.
Great. Well, thank you very much for the question, Oliver. And clearly, from the answer that came up on the screen, there's a strong opinion one way or in one direction on that question. I do think we have to take a step back and look at this and say, okay, if the objective is free and fair, or fair and free, however the order is supposed to be, trade, who can be opposed to that? I think that's what we want. And I think we may say that in many cases, historically, the U.S. has not always had the best trade deals for ourselves. I think we've tried to offer others good trade deals for a variety of reasons. So I think that's something we need to keep in mind. I think in the case of China, let's take that one first, because that's a big one, very near and dear to the heart of soybean farmers that I represent in the soy industry. We export 60% of the soy that gets produced in the United States in one form or another, beans, meal, or oil. And China is the biggest customer, not as big as they were 5 or 10 years ago, percentage-wise, but still a very big customer. And personally, I believe that if we can get back to something like the Phase One trade agreement that was signed on January 15th in 2020 and was hailed by President Trump, President Xi, and many as something that was really going to improve the way that the U.S. could interact with China on a trade basis. It was going to try and level the playing field and improve many of the problems that we had. And it started to do that. And then COVID hit, and then there was a change in administrations. But if we could get back to that, if this tariff that we've put in place today is a catalyst to get back to something like that, then I think we could have a good outcome here. Now, we'll have to see how it progresses. But if anything, this is a little selfishly from a U.S. soy perspective, this is not a bad time to be putting a tariff on and trying to get some feedback or some results from it, because normally our exports to China slow down at this time of year, and South America kicks in, and then we really pick back up again in September or October when we're harvesting our crop. So I've got a kind of a 5 or 6 month window that I'm looking at to see something happen there. And then in the case of Mexico and Canada, you know, they're very important trading partners. Mexico is usually the number 2 or 3 customer for U.S. soy, and we have a long relationship with Mexico, and we've done a lot of things between their industry and our industry. We have a fantastic logistical system, the way that the U.S. is so connected to Mexico. So that one, it looks to me like there's going to be a sort of a pragmatic outcome. Hopefully we will not actually see tariffs come into place on soy going into Mexico or other agricultural commodities. I hope something will be able to be relieved. Canada, that's one where there seems to be a real war of words going on, so I don't know about that. And let me just comment real quick on, and we'll probably get back to it, but the retaliatory tariffs. I think all of those, again, like I'm trying to view the China situation as maybe something that can have a good outcome, these retaliatory tariffs and the fact that there's a threat out there that they're going to be put in place, or there's talk that they'll be put in place, that opens up the door for negotiation, just like a free trade agreement does. We've all been calling, I think, at least we've been calling, on the need for more free trade agreements. We'd like to have the U.S. involved in more of these bilateral negotiations. Well, I don't know how our negotiators from the government are going to manage it, but they're going to have an awful lot of those going on when these, on April 2nd, the date we're waiting for these announcements about these retaliatory tariffs. So I'm trying to view those as something that maybe can bring positive change in trading relations. So yes, risks. I think our big risk is the U.S. is viewed to be a real reliable and consistent supplier, and this is maybe putting a little dent in that. So I think we need to quickly get through that so we can maintain our relationship as a reliable and consistent trade partner.
And, Alexis, do you see some of those same opportunities?
I'd maybe start on risks. So there is, I think, a risk about those business-to-business, buyer-to-seller relationships. We are hearing it from some of our members when they are talking to their buyers, say, in Canada. Obviously, we all hear about what's going on in Canada and really the move, some of the just anger that they're feeling towards the United States right now, their move as consumers to not buy American, to look for different suppliers. We are hearing that from our members who have had long-term relationships selling into Canada. Also, I think there's obviously some geopolitical risk that we have to acknowledge that is happening right now. So tariffs did go into effect. Let's also remember that for 3 days, March 4th, 5th, and 6th. And what we saw on specifically fresh produce, because when you put tariffs on right now, the immediate impact, fresh produce is coming across the border, both borders, back and forth every single day. We saw decreased volumes on those 3 days from our members. In particular, we're hearing that from members in Texas. So there was an immediate impact. Now we're kind of back to normal, but there are hard conversations, I think, going on with those business-to-business relationships. I do think, you know, there is also some opportunities. So in the fresh fruit and vegetable side, we know there are trade imbalances. When you look at the trade deficit, and I don't think that's always a great indicator, but it is one that is being talked about a lot. A lot of the trade deficit is being driven in the agricultural space by our horticultural produce trade. So we do think there are some opportunities as well to really talk about some of the underlying drivers there that we see for our members in the United States. Stable, reliable labor, regulatory challenges that they continue to have had over the past several years. And so we think it's an opportunity to try to level set some of the challenges to make them more competitive in the United States marketplace.
And Michael, same question to you as well.
Yeah, I think for us, we are an export economy as well. We exported about $8.2 billion to 145 different countries last year. 18% of the milk produced in this country is exported. So we need exports, and our exports are growing. I think the one word that comes to my mind in all of this is uncertainty. I agree with the other panelists here. We see opportunities in this if it's done with clear objectives and short term. I think the thing it brings is uncertainty in the marketplace. Jim hit upon reliability. When you're making pizzas, if you don't have cheese today, you're out of business. So it's a day-by-day deal. Our harvest is every day. It's perishable. So reliability is extremely important to our customers. I've had members tell me that they lost significant customers and Trump won, and still yet today don't have them back yet. So building customer relationships take a long time. They're built around trust, and when you lose that and that gets broken, that takes a time to repair that. Having said that, we see opportunities here. We have places around the world where we could be advantaged. I think the other uncertainty that this brings is we have $8 billion of CapEx slated for dairy infrastructure growth. So the business community doesn't do well with uncertainty. And what will be the returns, and do we continue? Do we go forward as the previous plans we had now that we're in this period of time? Do we wait? Do we hold up? What do we do? So those are other things that are happening within our dairy sector. Everett hit upon it as well. The speed with which this is happening, members are calling, wanting to know what this means, what that means, and I used to tell them, I don't know, hang on for an hour or two, and it will most likely change. We're in some fast-moving, ever-changing, challenging times here to balance all the interest. And our members are internationally as well, so they're on both ends of this a lot of times. And I would say another thing that's important to all of us in food and agriculture today, we're operating with integrated supply chains. We bring in things here, we make other things with them, and we export them out as something different and a value add. So they aren't just simple products a lot of the times. So, again, I'm with the rest of the panelists. We see opportunities here. Let's see how the next few months go. But we see opportunities because we need new trade agreements, and we've not had new trade agreements in the last 4 years or so. So for us, Mexico is our number one market. Canada's number two. And China's number three. So those have all three been in the news most recently.
Yeah, Jim, you mentioned the China relationship as well in the phase one agreement. Countering China's unfair trade practices was obviously a key pillar of Trump's trade policy during his first term. And Beijing's been on the receiving end of some of his opening tariff salvos. I was just wondering, where do you see the US-China relationship going from here? Is the phase one deal the vehicle that gets revived and push for those purchasing commitments and or not? And what does it mean for U.S. ag exports more broadly as well?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, and I touched on that a little bit in my first comments. But I think we can't We can't really underestimate the importance of China as a market for it, certainly for U.S. soy, but for many U.S. agricultural commodities. And I think it's a market where people, organizations like ours, have been working for a long time. U.S. farmers have invested a lot of money into those sort of relationships. And I think it's too big a market for us to just say goodbye to it overnight. And I think that in many cases that would be very, very difficult to do. So I think we have to try. As I mentioned before, I think the Phase One agreement that was negotiated, it took a lot of time. And, you know, there were several people, some of them are in this room, that worked very hard negotiating that agreement over many months. And it took a lot of work to get to that agreement. So I think if we can try and revive it or at least learn from it, that would be beneficial. You know, we all read in the press, and we talk to various organizations in China or various companies in China, people. I think they're less interested in having a trade war today than they were some years ago. In some ways, maybe they're a little better prepared for it because they have diversified their supply chain, just like we've diversified our industry's diversified its markets for our products. But that said, they do not want to get in a situation, in my opinion, where they're sourcing almost all of their needs of something like soy, which is a big import need of theirs, from one country in South America. I don't think they want that. They want a balanced group of suppliers, and I think we can offer that to them. So I think we have to try and think about the high level issues, and our government needs to do that, but balance that against the agricultural trade interests that are so important for our farmers. And I think, you know, I remember I was at a presentation or a meeting, and I heard at the time Vice President Xi make the comment that agriculture trade is the ballast in the relationship between China and the United States, and the sometimes stormy relationship, I think is how the translator put it. And I think those are very good words, because clearly that relationship can be quite stormy sometimes. But historically, agricultural trade has helped to balance that. So I hope that we can do that again, and I hope that that'll be something that this administration, just like the last time they did with the Phase One agreement, that they can pull that, make that a priority again.
And Everett, did you have any thoughts on the future of the U.S.-China relationship as well, where it's headed?
Well, I do. We'll see. I think one of the key points that has been raised is, at the end of the day, are we able to get any more market access out of this? Because we certainly have the leverage. And we've never had leverage like this before. And there's been persistent trade barriers in both tariff and non-tariff for many, many years. So hopefully this is it. We're going to get those resolved and open some markets. That's certainly the case with China as well. I do believe that the president is interested in negotiating an agreement with China. And I have a theory that it's going to be somewhat of a two. It's going to end up in kind of a bifurcated relationship with technology and both an investment and trade treated differently, and perhaps not decoupled, but certainly not integrated. And that's because a lot of that's national defense related. At the same time, for agriculture and for a lot of commodities. And other products, there needs to be the trade because we need the market, they need the food, right? So it's perfect. It makes a lot of sense. So to me, that's a natural, synergy that's going to evolve, and it's going to take some time. And, you know, the one thing that worries me the most is, what do we not see? You know, what is the black swan event that we don't see? And can we manage the turbulence between now and then? If we can, I think we may end up in a spot that might look better, perhaps, than it did even, you know, during the first term. But we got a lot of work to do.
I think Everett tried. I think, Jim, as well, China's too big to ignore. There are too many issues there that we can't just walk away from. And I like Everett's comment, they need food, especially. If you talk to Chinese politicians, one of the things they want to make sure of is that they don't have 100,000 or 10 million or 100 million people without food today. That is something for Americans we don't really think about every day. But that goes for 2 or 3 days, you've got a political uprising, upheaval inside your own country. So I think there's opportunities there, whether it's Phase One, whether it's something new. There's a lot of new stuff, new technologies, AI, other things. But China's too big to just walk away from. And if there's one thing that's there's bipartisan agreement on in this town, is that something needs to be done with China. So there's a political support for doing something with China, too. What that is, I'm not sure we could ever agree on, but there's certainly an alignment that we need to do something about China. So we're there.
Yeah, you know, there are very real issues and concerns going on with our relationship with China that needs to be addressed, or going on in China and how they operate, right? And so, like, underscoring that that is very real. But I do think, you know, while we may want to bifurcate the agricultural relationship, they do not want to bifurcate that relationship. It is interconnected because they know it is leverage in the United States as well. I think, you know, Jim mentioned something at the top about reliable, being the U.S. is a reliable trading partner. I think what China saw in 2017-18 is the U.S. wasn't a reliable trading partner, and that they needed to diversify their suppliers, right? And we see that more and more of Brazil's production coming online, corn, soy, beef, right? They're opening new market access to Brazil because that is a new supply chain that they can get product from. You know, when I look at the numbers from the fresh fruit and vegetable exports, we haven't recovered from that trade war with China. On average, from 2015 to 2017, we were exporting about $450 million worth of products. From 2020 to 2024, that has dropped on average to $236 million worth of fresh fruit and vegetable a year. So when you lose some of these markets, it's very hard to get them back. And I think, you know, for us, as we look to what's going on right now with Canada, with Mexico, which are our top two fruit and vegetable, fresh fruit and vegetable, fresh produce export markets, it's really concerning. When you lose those businesses, they look for alternative supplies, and then they stay with those alternative supplies. And I think we've seen that in China. And so just really being cognizant of the long-term impacts as we're trying to bifurcate that relationship, but I think China does not want to.
I want to hop over to Slido for a moment because we've got a question on China, which is particularly interesting. So this issue of the shipbuilding and some of the proposals that have come out of that Section 301 investigation, USTR, among many proposals for spurring domestic shipbuilding, has suggested that we could add a surcharge to Chinese vessels coming to U.S. ports, or mandate a share of U.S. exports being shipped on U.S.-made vessels. Our question from the audience is, are you concerned by the administration's Section 301 proposals on Chinese shipping, and will they negatively affect U.S. ag exports and impact competitiveness? I'm willing to throw this open to anybody that might have any thoughts on this.
I certainly have some thoughts. I'm glad that someone raised that, and I hoped it would come up in our discussion, because I think it should be top of our list in terms of a threat, a near-term threat to U.S. agricultural exports, because this is something that would cut across all commodities that would go in bulk vessels, and I guess possibly container vessels as well. And the idea that we would start to tax or put a levy of $1 million or $1.5 million on every vessel that is either Chinese-made or Chinese-flagged, or ship owners that may have a vessel on order in China, it would very significantly hurt the competitiveness of U.S. agricultural products. Simple math is, if you put $1 million levy on a ship, and if you're going to load 2 million bushels on that ship, 50 cents a bushel would be the cost. And that's not going to change the world market price. So whoever is ultimately selling that crop, the U.S. farmer, will receive 50 cents a bushel less for it. I think that is very problematic. And I talk with a lot of export companies. We have a lot of those as members of our organization. This is very concerning to them. And they are telling me that it is effectively really kind of shut off future trade between the U.S. and other countries around the world, companies in other countries today. And that's very concerning, because prices are low today. We want people around the world to be booking these low prices and creating demand, and that will hopefully take prices back up again. If we put something in place that essentially kind of shuts trade off because of this uncertainty, something totally different than tariffs, this is a different issue, I think that is a problem. And so hopefully people will kind of realize that there are so that this just is not a practical way to approach this problem.
Alexis?
Yeah, you know, I think we're concerned from the export side, but we're also concerned from the import side. We import a lot of our fresh produce And part of that is because of the seasonality of it, the counter-seasonal aspect of it, or just the non-competitive nature, right? Bananas, pineapples, things we don't grow in this country. And so the impact it could ultimately have, not just on our own producers who are exporting, but also consumers ultimately to pay higher prices. You know, we need more Americans to eat more fruits and vegetables. We don't eat enough to meet the 5 recommended servings a day, right? So anything we do to add cost, limit availability is bad ultimately for the health of our country. And so I think there's a two-sided, there's two sides to this coin, and both are problematic and concerning.
Yeah, just to pile on, I mean, this is, I think it's an underestimated negative impact. This concept is very impactful on how trade's going to be done, where it's going to be done. You could even have people avoiding certain ports because they don't want to pay the fee. It's just not worth it. So we're talking about throwing in a concept here that could, you know, for products that aren't, some of the margins aren't that high. So when you start throwing this kind of valuation, this $1 million port entry, this is going to be very impactful. So I hope it's well thought out. They are taking comments, and I hope that there are some other ideas that could get us, because we do have, it is a problem and it needs to be addressed, but I'm not sure that some of the remedies proposed are going to do it and might have some pretty negative impacts.
I think we've seen a taste of this during COVID when we were competing with the opportunity cost of containers going back empty. We couldn't get product on containers. So, and we knew what that was, and I think it'd only be a fraction of what this possibly could be. Everett raised comment periods. I think that's another place. Some of the turnaround time on these comment periods, the tariffs have already been announced before the comment period has been announced. I think having additional input from a broad cross-section of food and agriculture would be instructive and would be helpful. So I would beg for, give us a chance to interact and share some perspectives on some of these things.
And pivoting to Canada and Mexico, Trump signed the USMCA during his first term, and that agreement comes up for review next year, where parties will meet to decide whether to extend it or update it or continue to meet annually until it expires in 2036 for similar conversations. In recent weeks, the president's taken issue with Canada's market access for U.S. dairy, and multiple lawmakers are urging the Trump administration to put this on the table as part of that review process. Michael, I want to start with you. What would you like to see addressed as part of that review process next year?
Well, for us, Mexico's important as our number one market, but Canada, the pricing agreements in the USMCA on dairy pricing are to be rediscussed and reevaluated this year. So that's front and center for us. We have two issues on the Canadian on the dairy side of things. One is the TRQ administration, making sure that's administered fairly. There are such terms in there as regularly in the market, but it's difficult to get into the market because most of the tariffs go to those that are already processing Canada. So it's tough to get in there. Anything that's over quota is probably 250, 270% tariff on over quota. On the that's on the TRQ side, 90%. We have yet to fill the quotas. The TRQs. We are about 20. We run on average about 27% fill rate on the quotas. On the pricing issues, back when we negotiated the USMCA, I spent time, quite a bit of time with the folks at USTR on that and how do we navigate that. Part of the process we had there was the cross-subsidization and the pricing around Class 7 pricing scheme for raw milk. Once we did USMCA, they changed the name of it. It's now Class 4A, but basically they're pricing raw milk prices for protein-rich products at below the cost of production. So those are issues that we'd like to see addressed, two issues on Canada coming up. On Mexico, I'm with Jim. Seems as though the Mexican leadership has taken a different perspective and a different approach than some of the other countries. They've kind of maintained a low profile, tried to work with this administration, and seemingly making some real progress in being able to do that. So our focus is on Canada, and again, we want to see the USMCA extended. We think it's brought great value. It needs to be preserved. From talking to those who negotiate on behalf of Mexico and Canada with the USMCA, the concern is if the tariffs are in place, it almost negates the need to talk about the USMCA with the tariffs there. So we want to see it. We want to see it extended, and perhaps when we extend it, there are other new things we could add to it. The world is changing. New technologies coming about. There are new things to be discussed. So for us, some dairy, that's the issue. So we're pleased to see dairy being discussed. We just want to make sure we got the facts grounded in the facts and we make progress with it.
And maybe I'll throw this to Alexis and Jim. Is there anything as part of that agreement that you'd like to see updated or added on to as well?
I think from a soy perspective and probably from a bulk commodity perspective, I think that the trade is very important and not a lot. We just want to see it extended and no harm done in that process. I mean, there are discussions, and sometimes you hear points come up on different types of products that either the Mexicans or the Canadians want, and I think all of those are opportunities for our U.S. suppliers to be able to ship them a slightly different product. But it needs to be negotiated on open economic terms, and normally that's how it works, so that's okay.
For us and our members, you know, fresh produce, floral, specialty crops are some of the most traded commodities in the North American continent. USMCA, NAFTA before that really set that stage. We also I talked a little bit about that trade balance, what's driving it in the ag space, specialty crops, fresh fruit and vegetable exports and imports. And so we believe that tariffs can be a targeted tool to address some of the imbalances and inequities, but we want to have that conversation in a more narrow context of USMCA. That's not the conversation we're having today. It's hard to even think about for our members what that conversation is when they're counting down the days that a 25% tariff may hit their products and then the retaliatory measures that are on the flip side of that. And so we welcome, I think, that discussion and how we can continue to refine USMCA for our members in these products and making sure our consumers have access to these healthy, nutritious, fresh produce products and floral items. But it's not the conversation that we can really tee up to have today while we have this looming tariff threat over our members' heads.
Yeah, in the context of that tariff threat and the review, Everett, how likely is it that we see parties either agree to extend the agreement or agree to certain updates that need to be made in the near future?
It was going to be difficult regardless. There are so many issues on the table, and some of them are agriculture, some barriers to U.S. exports, corn and others, energy issues, the rules of origin on autos. There's just a whole litany of problems that had been identified both within and outside the agreement that would have made a quick renegotiation very, very difficult. However, I'm actually think there might be momentum here, because even though it looks very bleak right now, there's a lot of people who are vested in this relationship. And the kind of political input that you might not have seen had the situation not been as perilous, you know, under just a regular negotiation. I mean, there wasn't any real political room to move, but now, I mean, there's whole industries at stake. I mean, the autos and others. I also think that there's an interest, and I hope the administration believes this, there's an interest in settling that agreement to demonstrate that we can bring home an agreement and stick by it. Because if we're going to set rules, and the administration has rules that it wants to set, which I think is another reason they may be able to get an agreement done, there's certain precedents I'm sure they'd love to set with the USMCA. We need to get them negotiated. We need to stick to them. And they want to demonstrate that they can do it, two of our largest trading partners. There's a lot of issues dealing with China that they can kind of put a template in place that would demonstrate for others that there's a methodology here and a place to go. So I'm a little bit hopeful on that, although at this point in time, I would not predict the date. So to be seen, to be seen.
I think that's an important point that Everett made. This administration, President Trump did USMCA the first time, and it was an improvement of NAFTA. So I think, Everett, the point you made about extending it is extremely important to demonstrate that we can be adherent, we can adhere to the rules, and we can be expected to follow through on the things we've committed to. So I for those reasons, too, I'm optimistic this will be extended. We'll have to see how we navigate around tariffs at the same time we're talking about extending the agreement. But I think it would help us with China and elsewhere around the world, too, to say that we can be expected to follow through on prior commitments. May we improve on them, may we modify them with changing conditions, but we can be seen as following through.
Right, and I would just add my support of those comments, Everett, and I think, you know, I hope that what you're saying is true, and that's kind of what I have been thinking is, all of these changes and the things we're all kind of spinning our heads trying to keep up with are there to create a situation that allows negotiations to take place and really to get some results that we want. And so happy to hear others saying that same thing, and I think we all need to be supportive and patient, and I think the key thing that I think about is how do we make sure we don't too much damage our reputation as a reliable and consistent supplier. As Alexis said, some people are saying we're still suffering from that. I mean, how do we, in this time period, while all this stuff is going on, how do we make sure we're not hurting our reputation? I think that's a key thing we need to be thinking about in our industries.
So on to new markets. So the president is notoriously both a tariff man and a deal maker. And during his first term, he pursued multiple market opening deals with the UK, with Kenya, among others. So far in the second term, he said that the US will hold talks with the UK and with India on trade pacts of some kind. What do you make of these announcements? And are there any other markets you think the US should be working to open? Somebody on Slido has asked a similar question on should we be developing trade relationships with countries not targeted by Trump, such as small Asian countries. So where are these new markets that you think we should be working to open? Maybe I can start over with Michael.
We think he should come back, a trade agreement with the UK. Why not do that? It's another great market. They teed it up before. India, we look at populations. India, in our view, is just too big to ignore, too big to ignore. Will we get a holistic agreement that addresses all the concerns of India? No, not likely. But can we make incremental progress there? We need to look at that. It's too big to ignore. I think now's the time to do it. So, yes, that's there. I think the other thing is the Southeast Asia markets, the boundary countries to China, clearly opportunities there. And, again, I think diversifying our market is important. Like I say, we exported dairy products to 145 different countries last year. So there are a lot of places out there. Our product is protein rich. And the world is protein hungry, so there's a great opportunity in all of that for us. So we're optimistic. I think also certainty in these trade agreements. So India, for example, we don't fix every problem, but we can fix some of these problems around these certificates, and we can be confident that they're going to stick. Then we can invest capital. We can make the changes necessary to meet the needs and meet the requirements if we know there's going to be a market there. But if we negotiate something today on requirements and then they change next week, it's hard to make the changes in the system to comply. So we're optimistic about all those things. We need to be looking for opportunities in a lot of places. 1.4 billion people in India, it's just too big, in my view, it's too big to ignore.
I was going to go to Alexis. You obviously dealt with the Indian officials as well on that topic. Any thoughts on whether we'll get agriculture as part of that deal?
You know, I think there is an opportunity with India in particular right now. Modi has said, you know, he wants to move to a more export-focused economy. He wants to double the Indian economy and exports by 2030. You know, I have worked in various aspects with the Indian government in different roles. I was in India for the very first time when I was at USDA, the first time in 2016. And I can tell you it was probably some of the most contentious, difficult meetings I had ever had, and maybe to this day still have had. Fast forward when I was in India last year with USDA, totally different tone, totally different desire for a relationship. And so I think there is an opportunity in our bilateral relationship. It won't be everything. It won't be everything we want to see, but they are willing to think about, I think, and talk about exports in a way, U.S. ag exports to them in a way that they can see benefit for themselves. They're going to have to see that benefit for themselves. And I think, you know, one of the things from the fresh produce side, there's real opportunity. So India right now is importing over $550 million worth of produce from the world. At our record high, we were at $176 million. And that took a real hit with retaliatory tariffs on U.S. Apple exports there. Now, we've gotten them lifted. We're starting to rebuild that market. But again, once you lose some of that market share, it's really hard to get back. So I think from the fresh produce side, there's real opportunity as the Indian middle class continues to grow to be able to expand our footprint and relationships there. And I think there's a willingness there because they understand to be an export-focused economy, or at least Modi and his government does. That does mean you're going to have to bring some imports in, but what they are is going to be really targeted to how they see the benefit for either their own economy or their own consumers in a non-competitive way.
Really briefly, because we are wrapping up, but I'm going to go Everett and then Jim.
Just quickly, I think one, we need the trade agreements. We need them for market access. Hopefully the leverage will be used to get rid of some of these really persistent trade barriers. But I would look at Africa. We don't know what's going to happen with the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. It's a huge population. It's one of the few areas of the world where the population is projected to grow. And we need their critical minerals. So there's a deal to be done there. And that's true with some other economies as well, with Japan and Korea. There's things that we need to do together. And trade agreements don't have to be perfect, but they certainly can be a great way to frame the conversation and achieve some real outcomes. So this is the chance. I hope we do it.
And I would just say, you know, in terms of what countries to target, and I think India is important. It's not going to be the next China. It's going to be much different, but there is an opportunity there. Soy is protein rich, just like dairy is protein rich. And so there are a lot of countries around the world where people want to consume more protein. Africa's a place. Lots of places. And I think that's, as we think about where, from an agricultural perspective, where to focus on these trade relationships, I think to look at places where consumption is low today and likely to grow, and if there's a large population, those are really places where we have opportunities for the future to help them enjoy our high-quality, sustainable products from the U.S.
Well, we could certainly talk about this all day. There's a ton going on the trade front, but we are unfortunately out of time. And so could you please join me in thanking our panelists? And